And why I say that was because she was, it was difficult to know when she was talking, where she was getting.
Yes.
Or what she was talking about. Do you know that kind of speaker?
Yes.
Who are garrulous, but they don't seem to say anything.
She wasn't really sort of rational in the same way as Mrs. Billington Gregg was. I mean, not sort of articulate.
Not articulate. Mm. And one was possibly influenced a little because of her accent. She had a very, you know, sort of... I hate to say this, working class.
Did she really? Even as late as 19... Yes. What was this, 1935 or so,
yes.
Wasn't it? Did she really? Yes.
Oh, yes, it was very poor.
Yes, I see. So, I mean, what was this Women's Guild of Empire? I've heard a lot about it. It was a sort of fringe of the Conservative Party, really, was it?
Well, my impression was that it was at the general election... they didn't have any money. They were worried about money. I think they just depended on what the guilds paid to them each year. Mm. And my impression was that they suddenly had charabancs to send to all the guilds to bring them to a mass meeting to talk about anti-communism, anti-fascism. Mm. And my impression was that it was against the Labour Party, because that was the only party that had a chance of being returned as a government.
Yes.
And I think possibly she was extremely confused politically.
She was
really interested in some way in the status of women, but even then, in the guilds, you see, you didn't hear or see much about it.
Didn't you? Yes. And these guilds, it had a set of branches, did it?
Yes. Well, there were quite, I think she had about 40 or 50 branches.
Mm.
And they were run autocratically by one person.
Were they?
Yes, there was no committee to run them. For instance, when I was chairman of the North Kensington branch, I just arranged the speakers and they paid a penny or tuppence, which bought the buns and the tea for it.
Mm. So you were like a sort of dictator in your locality.
Yes.
She was a dictator, presumably. Was she in
yes.
charge? I mean, was there any committee at the national level?
Not that I knew of. I was never invited to one. I never heard of one.
Mm. It's very interesting, because it's just the same sort of structure as the WSPU, you see. Very authoritarian.
Yes.
What I don't understand is what relation it had, if any, to the fascist movement or the Conservative
Party. I don't think it
had
any.
Didn't it?
Oh,
it was anti-fascist as well as anti-communist, wasn't it?
Yes.
And but most of its supporters would have been Conservatives, would they, do you think?
Oh, I think that possibly the North Kensington women would vote with their husbands because they didn't know anything else. So if he voted Labour or Communist.
I see.
The Communists in the 1930s were a big organisation than they are now.
Mm.
They would vote that way.
Mm. But what did it sort of stand for, really? I mean, what was its programme?
Well, it was just Guild of Empire.
You mean it was sort of in favour of the empire in general?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's all I could make out. There was nothing written about it.
Do you
about Mrs. I've never thought about what she stood for, because there was just nothing there. But she possibly believed in the empire, and she ran these guilds on the as the name
implied. What did you actually do in your North Kensington branch?
All I did was to arrange speakers and to collect their pennies for their tea. And but I was extremely interested in those women, because they were I would have thought that the majority of them were on the dole. And very interested in them. And there was it was held in a church, and there was a very young parson, and I used to, who was quite a lot of, he came to the meetings sometimes, and he'd bring in some of his congregation. So it was really a social setup to interest women.
I see. So you had speakers on anything, really?
Just anything.
Yes.
Social credit was going. I can't remember all of them. Money reform, finance reform, all sorts of things. You know, these sort of splinter groups who are wanting audiences and wanting to talk.
Yeah.
And they all have an element of politics running through them. And but what was surprising to me was the interest that created, and I thought, well, all these women, if only their lives had, they had opportunities, how they would grasp them. But Mrs. Drummond, I really can't tell you much about her.
Your contact with her was very limited, was it? I mean, by telephone or letter, really. You didn't see her much in operation, except when speaking on platforms.
I met her on four or five occasions.
Did you? Yes. What was she like when you met her? I mean, you met her informally, did you, a bit? Then?
Yes.
What was she like?
It was such a long time ago. well, she was... penetrate. It was just rather a, would I do this or would I do that?
Yes.
Like when she called me, she wanted to see me, would I come on this platform for the Labour? And I was confused myself and muddled myself.
What did she look like at this stage?
She looked as she spoke. It sounds terrible saying she's working class, but...
No, I know what you mean. That does place her a bit.
Yes, rather like a charwoman.
Mm.
She was rather grey and very, rather shabby and, you know, rather stout. A little unkempt, maybe.
Mm. And she was running this as what direct? What did she call herself? She was, chairman or what?
Now, did she have a name? Well, it was her Guild of Empire.
It was entirely her affair, anyway. Yes. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, in a way, that really involved you in the women's movement because you got interested in the women for their own sake, in a way. And you ran this sort of semi-creche at the same time as the lectures were.
Yes.
Were run.
Yes.
So.
Well, then when. From Mrs. Drummond, I was most grateful to her sending me to this conference because I can see that I could possibly live a lifetime and never really understanding what the women's movement was about.
So it did two things for you, really. It also got you involved in the international women's movement.
Yes.
Through that,
and
you got involved...
the feminist world.
Yes.
The international and then the national one.
Mm. And then you got involved in this committee of the League of Nations on women's status, around about 1938 or so.
Yes.
And then I can't quite remember. That's right. And then there were these two women, Dorothy Evans and Miss Monica Waitley, who were ex-suffragettes who ran this subcommittee.
Yes.
Is that right? And you decided.
No, they didn't run it.
Mm.
I don't know why they came. They were just members of this, the Equal Rights International.
Mm.
I hadn't met them in London until I met them at Geneva. And now my inspiration for running an organisation on the status of the married woman came from the Fawcett Library.
Did it?
Yes, and was an inspiration from the suffragette movement, because when I was asked by Dorothy Evans to set up this committee, I joined the Fawcett's Library and I had time and I got all the books I could on the suffragette movement, and that rather pointed the way. If you get an idea and you just go out and get it. And you see, I was inspired by the way that that was the thing, get the vote at all costs. And of course the vote is the stepping stone to all other reform.
Yeah, yeah. What did you actually read in the Fawcett Library? Can you remember now? I suppose it's again a long time ago, isn't it? About the suffragette movement.
Couldn't remember.
Yes.
I read Strachey's book.
Oh yes, Our Freedom and Its Results, was it? Or,
I think so.
Or The Cause, probably, you read.
The Cause, yes.
Yes, yes. Because Ray Strachey was a major figure in the 30s. Did you ever meet her, actually, as a matter of interest?
No, I didn't.
Mm. Anyway, so this subcommittee, you thought was too much in the hands of unmarried women, really, did you? And so you eventually you decided that your Married Women's Association should sort of grow out of it,
yes,
is that right?
I wouldn't
would like it
say, say this.
Mm. Yes.
The Economic Reform Club, I think it was, and they had office there, and I hired a room and I had three meetings there, and then these other two members from the six-point group, I then got a solicitor on the committee and a journalist, and these suddenly said, I wrote, we have a new chairman. Well, I was so inexperienced, I didn't quite know what to do, but I could see they couldn't do anything because they were so silly themselves. But how the journalists stopped the meeting and said it would go on the agenda for the next meeting. And then the solicitor drew up a constitution, which we hadn't then got, and got it passed and all that sort of thing. But in that case, the six-point group would have stepped in, you see, and wouldn't have allowed it because they had appointed me and agreed that I should have this association. Mm. That I should do this association, and at least for a time, a year later, possibly it would have been, might have been all right to change the person that was doing the work.
So Dorothy Evans, the legal expert, and what was it, Olive Wakeford?
Yes, I've forgotten her name myself now.
Sorry, I mean...
Monica Wakeley. Yes.
Wakeley, yes.
Yes.
With her flowing cape, black
yes.
cape and red line cape.
Yes.
They weren't members of the six-point group. They were members of the subcommittee of the League of Nations, is that right?
No, they were the six-point group.
Oh, I see. Yes,
they
sorry.
Were the chairman and the secretary.
Sorry.
The Equal Rights International... British subcommittee, the chairman was Linda Littlejohn, who
you
took
met
me
at the Commonwealth
yes,
Conference.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, I understand.
And who
yes.
brought me into the feminist world.
Mm. Mm.
And she was quite an inspiration.
Mm. So it's not a name I've heard of at all, actually.
Linda, well, you see, she's dead. She died a few years later in the... Just after the war, she died. Monica Wakeley is dead, and also
Dorothy Evans.
Dorothy Evans, yes.
What about Anne Fraser? Where does she come in all this then?
Well, Anne Fraser was part of the Married Women's Association.
Later, was that?
Yes, and I can tell you how her contact with the feminist movement was. Quite dramatic. At the outbreak of war, I had after the war had been going a year, I had a new baby and I had toddlers, and I had to leave London because the bombing was. And I was worried about the Air Raid Injuries Act, which said everybody was to be compensated if injured, but not the housewife. But if she lost a leg or an arm or an eye, her husband could have an allowance to get a housekeeper. But you see, this was at such an outrage. And I was inadequate. I went to one or two conferences and pointed this out, but nobody had cottoned on to it. So, but then I had to leave London, and I kept writing from London. And of course, the bombing upset everybody. The association disappeared. I kept writing, telling them to hold committees. And but when I came back to London a year later, everybody was abub with this outrageous act. And the Ministry of Pension said they'd never give the housewife an allowance. What nonsense, she's the economic dependent of the husband, not the government. But then all the organisations were agog, and they had an organised meeting. This was combined organisations on the plinth of Trafalgar Square. And Anne Fraser, who'd never heard of the feminist movement, heard this and joined, and was very active for several years.
She's still alive, is she?
Oh yes, she was younger than most of us.
Could you put, you don't know her address, do you, or do you? I'd very much like to see if she also knew Teresa Billington Gregg.
Well, she did, and she is important if we can get hold of her, because she worked with her on the Women for Westminster Committee.
Well, yes.
And you see, there was this rumpus that I heard of the complaints about Billington Gregg. But knowing Billington Gregg, I wouldn't take much notice of that. I can understand a daughter living with Billington Gregg might find, you know, the feminist movement too much. Billington Gregg, and this might be in something in relation to the daughter, said to me once, when we were married, we agreed only to have one child, but I have regrets about that. I think it would have been better if we'd had two.
Interesting.
So that is possibly the she thought the daughter had rights too, and not just she and her husband. But right up until just before she died, I met her and her husband in Hampstead, and they seemed a very loving couple.
Yes, I have the impression that it was a very unusual marriage in a way, but a very successful one.
Yes.
That's the impression I have anyway. Because she wasn't, she was an unusual woman, there's no doubt about it.
Oh, she's a very good speaker.
Was she?
Oh, yes. Delightful.
Why do you say that? I mean.
She wasn't humorous. I like humour in people talking, people who can smile. Recently on a talk on before the budget, there was a man, he might be at Oxford, who I think teaches finance at one of the universities, a man by the name of Oppenheimer.
Oh, I know him well. He was a contemporary of mine at Nuffield, a charming person.
Yes. Well, it came over so much on television because he didn't laugh, but he smiled at his own ideas from time to time.
Oh, he would, yes. He is a bit of an actor as well, actually, so, I mean, he got the two together. But did Mrs. Billington Gregg do that?
No, she didn't. But she made up for it in another way. She was precise and earnest and an emotional speaker. She felt this was the right thing to do and therefore it should be done. And so she came over like that.
Very forthright, definite. down to earth.
Is logical. Very good indeed.
So your connection with her really runs from 1938, when she joined the organisation at its earliest.
I didn't meet her until 1938 or 39.
Until she died in 64.
Yes.
So, can you just describe again for me how she came up to you to join? I mean, what happened?
She joined at that meeting, little meeting at. In Brunswick Square there was a club, the Minerva Club, where it was a suffragettes club. Did you know anything about
it? Yes, I've heard of it. Yes.
Well, it was a very shabby place, you know, run on a shoestring, but it was a place for these old women where they could meet, and I think they could even stay the night if they were in town. I was speaking to him, had a meeting there, and she was there, and she just joined. She joined, but she wasn't much in the picture. But then she started in earnest in, I think, 1943, the Women for Westminster. And I saw more of her then. I wasn't in the Women for Westminster. Now, about Anne Fraser, I'll search to see if I can get her address.
She lives in London somewhere, does she?
Yes,
does she?
North London.
I see. You just couldn't find her address, or... I mean, I don't want to embarrass you in your relations with her. I mean...
I intended doing was to ring her up, saying you were doing this biography of Billington Gregg, and could she give us some reminiscence? It was... it was just that she told me off for... denigrating her husband, which was the last thing I wanted to do, because he's a very nice man and I admired him very much.
Yeah.
So I hung up on her. I was going to be told off about that.
No, well, it might be a way of restoring contact with her if you rang up. So, but I mean, you know, I don't want to make things embarrassing for you.
No, that wouldn't be at all embarrassing. But I'll try and do that for you.
Would you really? I'd be awfully grateful if you would, because, I mean, it sounds as if she'd be very interesting.
Well, she's very expressive, and she might be able to tell you a lot more than I could.
Well, if they had... I'm not a sort of uncritical admirer of Mrs. Billington Gregg, so if you could tell her that, then she won't be so worried, perhaps, about talking, you know. I have two minds on her altogether, really. I mean... I admire some side of her, and I realise that she was difficult as well. She's like all of us, she's grey, you know, she's not black or white, really, I think. Anyway, after 43, did she actually hold a position in the Married Women's Association?
Well, she was a vice president. But later we drop all vice presidents. Because I realise that it's more impressive to have lawyers and members of parliament. So then I pursue them, and now we're crowded out with them.
So, did she come to meetings quite a lot?
The point of meeting would be we'd have a meeting at the Caxton Hall. Now, after the... in 1948, we stopped having conferences because people just didn't come. You see, during the war, you'd have crowded meetings because there wasn't anything else to go to. But then husbands came back from the wars and people started taking up their old life, and life becomes fuller, so they're not in so much need.
That's interesting, because, as you said, at the beginning of the war really... disrupts everything, so the association, in a sense, collapses.
Yes.
But then, as the war moved on, it actually prospered more, did it? Because of lack of recreation, really.
Well, in 1943, we took this Blackwell case to the Court of Appeal, and the association jumped from a couple of hundred to 2,000 members, with odd branches and opportunities of, you know, going on developing. But as it seemed to me, they didn't. They fell apart because we did nothing to occupy them. We just talked about the rotten status of women.
Well, they should have had something practical to do, you think, actually.
Now, yes. A little while ago, I was asked to speak at some big organisation where there were 15... It was a conference of all their branches. See, it might have been Women's Institute or Women's something, you see. And it was in, I think it was Canterbury or someplace like that. So I give a half an hour's talk. I ask for questions and discussion. I get one or two questions, and it's over. And I think that's simply amazing. This affects all of them. And yet they're so interested. They're anxious to get on to the group that was doing the choir, the one that was doing the lampshade, that was doing a bit of theatrical things. I don't regret what the association has done at all, because I think this is the vital work. This is what we're doing, is to change the law.
Yes.
And after that, it will be to educate people, or in the process of changing law, to educate people that women are just as important as the person who brings home a pay packet. I went to a socialist medical conference at Oxford a few years ago, and there were some trade union representatives, and a doctor had just been holding forth at a conference on child and maternal welfare, and he said it was scandalous that women could go to the Ministry of Health and ask for free dinners because the children weren't getting enough to eat and milk, and the medical officer of health check up on the man's earnings and then go back and say, no, your husband earns too much, and leave the women and children like that. And he said, he was a medical officer of health, this man, and he said, I have men earning 30 and 40 pounds a week, and the women and children are on the borderline. And yet nobody does anything about it. So, of course, we tried to make as much capital out of this as possible. Not that we did any good. However, he was on television, and that farmer that comes on... He said it was a lot of rubbish and all this sort of thing. And he came on and talked against him, you see, which diluted it all down. It was a Dr. Byrne in, I think it was Wallasey, someplace like that. Why was I telling you? Oh, now I wanted to tell you what these trade union men said. So I talked about this. There was a doctor in the chair. He would have none of it. So I lobbied some trawler men from Liverpool, and one man said, a young man, he said, well, I agree with you, he said, I bring my, really bring my paycheck, and I don't change it, and I give it to my wife, and I say to her, now, I want so much, so and so out of that. And he said, we agree. He said, and that to me is partnership. And I said, yes, I agree that too. She knows where money is going, and you look upon her as an equal. He said, well, missus, I'll tell you this. The industrial worker, when his son is getting married, will call him aside and say, he won't give him any advice on the responsibilities or the emotional side of marriage. He'll just say to him, don't tell your wife how much you earn. That's his advice.
Obviously still got quite a lot of fire in you about women's position, so to speak, in society. Did Mrs. Billington Greig, did you feel she had a sort of underneath her still a lot of indignation about women's position?
Indignation, yes. When you talk to her or when she debated, I can remember, this was a committee meeting, a woman had some plan, so a special meeting was called and Billington Greig was there. She was furious. She stood up and she went for this woman. She said, you've wasted all our time. We've all given up our evening. And what you've done, nothing but a lot of rubbish. Something like that, she said. And we were all thinking that, but didn't have the courage to say it.
Interesting. She came, she wasn't on any committee or anything, was she, or was
no,
she?
No,
she just came along, sort yes, of, now and again.
Right. She was a vice president, and when we had the difficulty, I asked for her advice, and was I doing the right thing doing this or that, you see? Yes, no, I admired her very much. She was one of the suffragettes whom I did admire. I thought she was jolly fine.
Did you have other suffragettes actually in the organisation?
I met those two on the 6-point group.
Mm.
I met very casually a few others. I attended a meeting where they were.
Mm. But you respected Mrs. Billington Greig's judgment, did you? Really?
Oh yes, she was sound.
Yes.
Really sound.
Yes, interesting. Because in a way, I think in a way she wasn't really sound earlier on. She was too fiery, you know, too difficult really earlier on in her life.
Fiery in what way?
She just told people where to get off, broadly speaking. I think that's really, you know, if she disagreed with them, she believed so strongly in her principles that she wouldn't have any sort of disagreement or tolerate compromise. Do you see what I mean? I think that's the impression I have of her in her early career. But presumably she'd mellowed quite a lot by the time that you...
I think if that's in your psychological makeup, it brings its own rewards. You see, you can waste an awful lot of time with people who don't know what they're about and who muddle you and muddle everybody else. I wouldn't look upon it as a fault.
Mm.
I'll just say that's how she went along.
Of course, it does lead to great energy, of course, and great achievement, doesn't it? If you know what you want and you set out to do it. The only problem is that you've got to get supporters, haven't you? Otherwise you won't get anywhere.
Well, you see, women, because they're mothers, because in the past they didn't get access to higher education, were backward as compared with many men. And so they have to be pushed along, and leading doesn't always do. I'm of a mouse-like disposition. I just give in. I hold forth what I feel is right, but I wouldn't take it, you know, much further.
Mm. She was a different sort of figure, I suppose, wasn't she?
Yes, I would say. Yes.
And organisations need both types of person, I think, actually. You say you actually met her husband later on, did you?
Yes.
I mean, what was he like, actually, as a person?
I couldn't remember, and it was just a matter of, you know, a few words. But when I met them in the street, he was, you know, gripping onto her in the most affectionate way, and looking admiringly up to her, as though she was the kingpin of his life and his home.
And you've got the impression of a very happy pair, really, at the end of their life. Yes. I think they were happy throughout, actually. One thing that Fiona said was that he was, in some ways, difficult. He used to have periods of silence where he just wouldn't talk at all. And that was awfully difficult. It's really a temperamental thing. It was difficult not only for his wife, but for the whole family.
Terrible.
But that was the only thing, and that wasn't a personal thing between them. It was just that he had a sort of disability, in a sense. I mean, he just would have these moods of depression and so on, which made things difficult. But that's the only thing she said was difficult, really, between them. Did she ever talk much about her early suffragette days to you, or
no.
in meetings? I mean, because
no.
That's again the impression I got from Fiona. She put that behind her, really. She was always looking forward to the next thing, you know, somehow.
Well, one tends to, you know. Looking at the past, I feel it's boring, or people who want to go back, oh, look, we've achieved this. To me, it's insignificant, and any person or organisation, to me, are just cogs in a wheel. We do what we can, but it doesn't rest on us. If we go under, somebody else will come along. I spoke to someone this morning who knew Mrs. Billington Gregg, but she wasn't able to say much at all about her, but she remembered a conference where she went, and speaking for the association, we were trying to get, not that it's done much good, trying to get an attachment of earnings bill in the Commons, which we succeeded in doing. And Mrs. Billington Gregg was speaking for us at a conference, and there's a good number of trade union people there, and they couldn't take it to attach earnings for wife and child support. But how it eventually became law, and only effective in a few cases.
I had the impression that she really rather grew, I wouldn't say hostile, but critical of the trade union movement in her later life. As you know, in her early life, she was very much attached to the Labour Party. But in the later life, she was rather more concerned, I imagine, about the way in which trade unionists, male trade unionists, don't, on the whole, concern themselves with women's interest as such. So that would rather fit, I think, with what you're saying.
Well, it's the same. You see, somehow women. I've noticed this at meetings. When I used to flit around to all these reformist groups, in the Labour Party, women leave the speaking to the men. Whether the women have not sufficient aggression in their psychological makeup, I don't know. But you see, there are many, many more men who can express themselves fully and who are pleased to talk, but Where there are husbands and wives, the wives just end.
You find that absolutely in universities, in any meetings I talk to, even on the women's question, you'll find the men on the whole ask more questions than the women, and in tutorials the women will sit there writing down their notes, but they won't ask any questions, they won't disagree with you, you know, it's a matter of upbringing, really, I think.
Well, it's upbringing, or it's a sexual competition.
Mm.
It seems to me something to do with that. They want to... there's a fear of the male.
Mm.
Do you think?
Mm. Yes, maybe. I mean, you know more than I would about that. It's rather difficult for a man to know that, really.
Well, unless you feel you're as well educated as anybody else, you hold back because you don't feel you know as much and you've got the ability to say what you know.
Mm.
That is the point. But it's a pity because if women, you see, in the Married Women's Association, I'm the one that does all the speaking, and that's really true. And why I do it is because I was able to glean the first few meetings that I ever went to was, if you're doing any work, you've got to be able to say it. So although it was a terrible trial to begin with, I persevered. And I've urged my members of my committee to speak. And you see, at these luncheons, it's left to me, just occasionally one or two will get up, but seldom ever. And it's such a pity because when you get over that initial anxiety, it's easy, isn't it?
I agree, yes. How did you yourself get over that initial anxiety?
Well, I just persevered, and I always had in my hands something to read if I forgot what I was to say.
That's
I was
important.
Able to refer to it, and eventually I would prepare what I was going to say and make out notes, but I've never used them because I spoke fluently and could say everything. I'd put them under headings in my mind and then just go through them.
Quite right.
What?
Quite right. I mean, that headings are very important, I think,
your mind,
giving
yes. And then you just deal with one aspect and then go on to another. And now I prepare nothing and I speak. You see, at the House of Commons luncheon, which is really an important aspect of our work, it's nice for the members to buy a ticket to come and bring their friends. You see, it's a privilege. And then the MPs that we meet, what the association says, they listen to, and they listen in earnest because they never know when they're going to be confronted with what we're putting over. So now, because I've persevered, I can now listen to a speech and again, in my mind, I'll say that and that and that and get up and speak.
Without writing anything down.
Without writing anything down. And it's just a matter of practice. It's like everything.
I agree. Yeah.
It's like education.
Yes.
It's like ideas. If you don't meet the ideas, you don't hold opinion.
Did you have a model, actually, as a speaker? I mean, did anyone impress you, especially as a speaker, who has influenced your style of speaking?
Well, when I was a nurse, and we used to go for our lectures at Adelaide University, I was always impressed with the male lecturers, but that was because I was a young woman. No, I think that I bring this my critical faculty into being with all speakers, and I class them. And I think Mr. Edward Heath, I hope you're not a Conservative.
Well, I sometimes vote Conservative, sometimes Labour. I waver, actually.
Yes, I see. Well, I think Edward Heath is the worst speaker
entirely
ever
heard absolutely
in my
agree with
life.
You.
Mm. And he thinks the electorate have got the brains of animals.
I quite agree with that.
To say what he does to the electorate.
Mm. I quite agree.
But I think the Conservative Party are pigs to use him for the election and then plunge the knife into the poor wretch after. Don't
yes.
you?
Yes, I think he's a very bad speaker. He somehow doesn't speak from the heart, something. Don't you feel? I mean,
well, also in each of these last three elections, I feel that he's learnt a speech from his public relations
precisely.
Officers. And he can't hide that because he's bothered with this prepared speech.
And the speeches are so bad anyway.
Terrible, dreadful.
I mean, this is quite regardless of the content. I mean, it's just so badly delivered. You wouldn't think he'd ever been in politics. I mean,
yes.
They,
and,
I entirely agree with that.
And all these, you see, all these his ministers have built him up and chorused whatever he says, and now because they've lost a couple of elections, they want to get rid of him.
Mm.
Well, I think they might have had the decency to hide it a bit. I can understand wanting to get rid of him, but to
yeah, you weren't at all influenced by Mrs. Billington Greig actually in your speaking manner, were you? I mean, you'd already formed your speaking style by that by the time you heard her, did you?
Well, I think I had so many inhibitions to get over that I wasn't thinking of being influenced by anybody. All I wanted to say was to be sensible and to speak up and say what I believed was right.
Yes. What did she actually look like on the platform? I wish I had met her. She was rather tall, wasn't she?
Tall and, you know, sort of middle-aged thickness. And she was very motherly. Have you got that from anybody you saw?
No, I hadn't realised that.
Yes, very motherly and almost to have been affectionate. But on the other side, you see, she could be very nasty. I knew that. The way she'd speak about, you know, some people, that lack of intelligence and ability, without her brown eyes flashing.
In a way, she was rather arrogant, was she, then, in her intelligence? She expected everyone to be as intelligent as she was. Is that right?
I don't know. I think... I found her... I didn't see that side of her nature at all.
No.
But I think quite possibly Anne Fraser, if I can find her.
It would be a great help. It's not that I'm looking for dirt, so to speak, on Mrs. Billington Greig. I want to get the rounded picture of her as a sort of complete person.
So you're writing on another aspect of the suffragette movement.
That's right, yes. I'm really particularly interested in the split in 1907, you see, where Mrs. Theresa Billington, as she then was, diverges from the WSPU.
Yes.
And obviously all these subsequent developments shed a certain amount of light on that.
And you've, of course, read the Pethick Lawrence.
Oh, yes.
And she was a lovely woman.
You knew her as well, did you?
Yes.
Did you really?
Oozing charm, only for a short time.
When did you know her? Sort of, she a member of the association as well?
No, but she came and spoke
Did she?
At a meeting or two. And then she, I think, had a stroke, and that was the end of her. But there, she must have been very handsome when she was young, Pethick Lawrence. And what did you think about Shoulder to Shoulder?
Oh, well, I don't know. What was she like as a speaker when she came to
Who,
speak?
Pethick Lawrence?
Yes.
Oh, beautiful. Lovely.
Was she? Because she must have been quite old then, wasn't
yes,
she?
Yes, yeah, 65, I suppose.
Mm.
And something got on. She was sitting next to Lady Summerskill, and she had to go out because, much to Summerskill's amusement, because some food got into one of her plates. And I said to Summerskill, well, we'll be like that soon. Oh, no, she was a lovely speaker, yes.
What sort of emotional speaking?
Emotional. She rather oozed charm.
Mm.
Which the downrightness of Billington Gregg, you wouldn't say that was her, but Pethick Lawrence, mm. yes.
Because one of the things, one of the words you used about Mrs. Billington Gregg was emotional speaker.
Yes, but the emotional, but that didn't ooze charm. It was an emotional speaker. This is the right thing to do. This is wrong that that women should be treated like this.
Not sentimental emotional,
no.
but passionately emotional.
Passionately and downright, where Pethick Lawrence was eloquent and smiled a lot and had a very sweet voice, where Billington's was rather, you know, hard hitting on the nail.
Was it? Yes, rather definite. What did she speak rather like Lady Stocks?
Yes.
A bit? I mean, the rather English bit. Sort of directness,
yes.
like
yes.
that.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
That's interesting.
But very entertaining. I mean,
was
you
she?
Could listen to her, yes.
Was she? Though without humour. Without... Yeah.
Yes, without humour,
mm.
I would say. Has mm. anybody else said that?
On the whole, yes. On the whole, yes. Mm. I think they have. Certainly she was very humourless as a young woman. There's no doubt about that.
Mm.
I suppose the world was all too... Everything. She felt everything so serious, so strongly, that you mm. couldn't laugh. I mean, in a sense, if you laugh, then... To some extent, you're acquiescing in things, aren't you, I suppose?
Mm.
You're admitting that some things will never be put right, perhaps, or some things...
But Pethick Lawrence laughed through what she was saying, and she had a very musical voice, and she rather a handsome woman, too.
Mm. Mm. Because one thing... I mean, you say that... Theresa Billington Gregg could be very critical of people,
mm.
but as I understand it, wouldn't be she wasn't a gossip, was
oh,
she?
No.
She wouldn't do that sort
oh,
of thing.
No gossip at all.
No, no.
Oh yeah. No, it was hard hitting, you know, but to the person, almost.
Mm. And she wouldn't be mind saying it to them in certain.
She wouldn't mind saying it to them, and, or saying it to anybody else concerned.
Hmm. Hmm. Because one of the things about the old suffragettes is that there's a lot of gossip goes on, as you must know. I mean, a lot of gossiping about each other. And I don't have the impression that Theresa Billington Gregg was ever that type at all. She wasn't... She had views, but she wasn't a person who would fritter her time away gossiping about personalities, that sort of thing.
Tell me what you think of Shoulder to Shoulder.
Yes, well, I thought, what sort of issue would you go to Mrs. Billington Gregg for advice on when you were in the Married Association? Mm.
Well, anything we decided to do, and I would let her know, possibly with pride that we're doing our job, and in respect of her being a vice president.
You did that with all vice presidents, did you?
No, some vice presidents are inaccessible. You see, we court MPs to put them on our note paper to influence other MPs to look into the status of the married woman. It has a little bit of a snowballing effect. And you see, now I feel that it won't be long. There's the anti-discrimination bill now.
Mm.
It won't be long before there's a bill on our lines in Parliament. And I'm expecting that it will be from the Home Office. That's what I'm hoping, another white paper on partnership.
Mm.
See, in the March election, in the Labour Party manifesto, it was to raise the status of women and reform property law in marriage.
Mm.
Well, I presumed that that was because from the Law Commission there's a bill in draft to hand to the government on equal ownership of the matrimonial home. I would have presumed that.
Mm.
But we had the woman organiser from the Labour Party to speak at a meeting recently.
Mm.
And she says that they've studied partnership in committee and it's now Labour Party policy. The problem we're dealing with now is supposing a government passes the bill that... Oh, excuse me.
Sorry, I'm going on too long.
that we hand around.
Mm.
And it comes into the Commons, there'll be a lot of opposition because the enforcement is so weak.
Mm.
So we're working on that at the moment.
Mm.
And we've got several QCs on our notepaper, and I'm very anxious never to bother them.
Mm.
And unless it's something vital.
Yeah.
And I've got a plan out for enforcement influenced by the Race Relations Act and now the White Paper on Discrimination.
You've got to strike a good balance, haven't you, between getting equal rights enforced but not antagonising people unduly and so setting the cause back.
Well, I can see it becoming law and just going by the board, don't take any notice of it, not necessary, and the women being too ignorant to try and enforce it. So it's like anti-discrimination and race relations. It needs education and conciliation and encouragement.
Mm. So going back, I mean, to your situation in the 1950s, do you think Mrs. Billington Greig would have been... What do you think her attitude to Women's Lib as a sort of organisation would have been, really?
Oh, I think she'd have torn it in pieces.
Would she?
Yes, that's what I think.
Why?
Well, because of the way they started off, they weren't going to have any committees, they weren't, and Hubbits, I don't know anything about them, really, but Mary Stottis let drop a little bit of gossip, you see, and then they had a paper they were circulating which was pretty disgraceful.
Mm.
You know, the sort of anti-bra and anti-pants.
Yes, I mean, she wouldn't have liked the sort of sex aspects of the Women's Lib movement, would you think?
The bringing out the worst, pornography, everything, trying to, and looking over backwards to be radical, you see, without being practical about it. I think the Women's Lib, but you see, I wouldn't speak in public against the Women's Lib.
Oh, no, no, that would be
very... I wouldn't say anything about them.
No.
Because I think at least they're organising, they have a meeting of 1,500 people.
Mm.
They talk about practically nothing, and this is just gossip. And you're not a communist, no?
No. Mm.
there's a communist influence running through.
Mm.
That doesn't matter, long as you know.
Mm.
You see, and the of course, I'm against the women's lib because they'll have nothing to do with equal partnership in marriage.
Mm. Won't they? I mean, why not, actually?
Well, don't ask me why not, because I just don't know.
Mm.
It's the communist idea, I think, that.
Just all going, doing away with the family, you mean?
Yes, yeah. All women should go out to work and park out the children.
Mm.
If they come down to it, they possibly wouldn't be like that when they've got to organise it.
Mm.
But you see, and another thing, the element of one-parent families. Well, when you've got one-parent families, you've got to put up with them. But to agitate, to do away with marriage, you see, Jill Tweedy.
Mm.
Who comes on television and as though she's an authority. I know she's had a terrible experience with a marriage. Well, that might happen to, it's happened to men, where they've had their children swiped away from
them
and not being able to know what's happened to them.
Mm.
So you can't condemn marriage for that. That's just bad luck that you've married the wrong person.
Mm.
And she comes on, she doesn't believe in marriage, no marriage at all.
Mm.
Well, that's just madness. Marriage is a commitment and the registration of a father.
I agree. Anyway, you think all this aspect of women's lib would have made Mrs. Billington Greig very, very hostile?
Very hostile.
Would have got her hackles up, really.
Yes.
You think? Yes. Yes. One other thing I wanted to ask you was what you thought of Mrs. Drummond in the Shoulder to Shoulder programmes.
Well, you know, I can't remember her.
And did she look, as you remember, a very dumpy figure, wasn't she? Yes, and rather dumpy. Sort of humorous.
Well, she was called General Drummond.
The General, yes, yes.
But I think that was because she was a good tub thumper. And
oh, yes, I just wondered if it reminded you at all of Mrs. Drummond as you knew her later.
Well, I can't remember her.
Mm.
And besides, I tended to get a bit bored with it.
Yes, yes, yes. So, I mean, it's a marvellous thing to be able to look at the television programme and actually to have known some of these people, and you're really very lucky, and much more lucky than I am on that.
Pethick Lawrence was crazy what the character they put.
Is that so? You presumably also saw Lord Pethick Lawrence, did you?
I've seen him, yes.
Why was that wrong, do you think? And what was wrong with their portrayal of him?
Well, I don't remember him in the film at all.
Mm.
He was there, wasn't he?
Oh, yes.
No, I don't remember him. But it was Mrs. Pethick Lawrence. You see, Lord Pethick Lawrence, I met after his wife's death.
Did you?
When he's then very old and in the House of Lords, and I'm lobbying him on partnership, and he can't see forward or backward. So he's just a blur. But she was an animated, eloquent creature, and all she's written. She wrote a book, didn't she?
Well, My Part in a Changing World was
her
autobiography.
Right. Well, that is Mrs. Pethick Lawrence. That is her character.
Mm. Mm.
And the person in Shoulder to Shoulder was nondescript.
Yeah. What do you mean when you say Lord Pethick Lawrence couldn't see forward and couldn't see back?
He couldn't see partnership was a right. You see, like, I could think a feminist would. He's a lawyer, he's mixed up with divorce and thinking in terms of what you do at the end of a marriage, and couldn't think, which is strange because what we put forward is what happens in the normal marriage.
Mm.
Wouldn't you agree?
Mm, yeah.
With in greater or lesser degree, and providing you have the law and everybody respecting that, it doesn't matter if she says you have it all, dear, or that way. The point is the law should uphold that that is the proper status for women.
So anyway, he didn't, so to speak, buy your whole program when you were...
Not at all.
I see. What impression did you have? Did you feel that he was on top when you saw him, or was he really very old and not able to adapt?
I think possibly the things that he is interested in, he was all right, but... I think he wasn't going to take on anything new or agree with it.
No, I see.
And I think that he was thinking in terms of the law, of enforcing a man when he deserts his family.
Yes. Look, it must be your lunchtime now. I mustn't keep you...